Every book has been rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street and building has been renamed. Every date has been altered. History has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. George Orwell, 1984.
This is how liberty dies.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host Scott with Uncle Ian, and today we are talking about the Ottoman dictator Enver Pasha up against the current president of Turkey, Recep Erdogan. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We have created a knockout competition to determine the single most significant dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Uncle Ian, please tell us about Enver Pasha.
Thank you, Scott. Ismail Enver was born in 1882 in Istanbul in what we now call Turkey. Actually attended a number of military academies, first graduated in 1903. By 1906, he'd been commissioned as a major in the army, was based in Salonika, and he'd joined a revolutionary body called the Committee for Union and Progress. In 1908, he first came to the fore in the national affairs of the Ottoman Empire as one of the reformers known as the Young Turks. Before we look at the Young Turks, let's look at the Ottoman Empire. By the middle of the 15th century, the headquarters or the capital of the Ottoman Empire was Istanbul, previously known as Byzantium, and was also known as Constantinople for many years. So suddenly, the city which had been the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire became the capital of a Muslim empire. At its height, in the 17th century, the Ottoman Empire stretched across three continents, across North Africa, all the way to Morocco, up through the Balkans, almost to the gates of Vienna, and south to Egypt, through the Arab countries, and across to Mesopotamia, all the way down through the area that we now know as Iraq, and also east to the Caucasus region, roughly between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, through we now know as Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. So the Ottoman Empire was at its height in the 17th century, progressively lost territory in the face of 19th century independence movements and ongoing colonial efforts by the what we call the major powers, or what they call themselves, the major powers. In 1830, Greece declared independence from the Ottoman Empire. In 1878, the countries of Romania, Montenegro, and Serbia could become independent. Cyprus was taken over by the British, and in eastern Turkey, the area known as Anatolia, which is basically that the Asian component of modern Turkey, three provinces were given to the Russians. In 1881, France took Tunisia. In 1882, Britain took Egypt. In 1911-12, Italy invaded Libya. In 1912, Albania, Macedonia, and the northeastern Greek region known as Thrace all broke away from the Ottoman Empire. So it's no wonder that our history teacher at school used to enjoy the line from Tsar Nicholas I that the Ottoman Empire was the sick man of Europe. In 1914, the Ottoman Empire still stretched southeast all the way to Baghdad and Kuwait, south through Palestine, the Red Sea coast down to Yemen. When you think about your atlas, that incorporates some pretty significant cities in history and in religion. Jerusalem, Damascus, Medina, and Mecca were all part of the Ottoman Empire in 1914. The reigning Sultan, Abdulhamid II, had come into power in 1876. He implemented a new constitution in order to try and make his reign stable. And it was stable up until 1909. At that point in time, he was overthrown. The new Sultan was his brother, Mehmet V. As well as being Sultan, he was also the Caliph of Islam and had the authority to declare jihad, or holy war. At this point in time, the story of Enver becomes entwined with the story of the Ottoman Empire. The Young Turks from the Committee for Union and Progress also included Major Ahmed Cemal and Mehmed Talat, and we'll hear a little bit more about their officers shortly. Jointly, they had a very high level of national pride, a belief that the military could restore the territory that had been taken away from the Ottoman Empire, and they believed very strongly that the Ottoman Empire could still be a force in European, Asian and African affairs, and they were very keen to restore the national prestige of the Ottoman Empire. I don't think they liked being called the sick man of Europe. In 1909, Enver was posted to Berlin as a military attaché. It was there that he first saw the structure and the armaments that were available in the German army. In 1911, he went to Libya as part of the Ottoman defence against the Italian invasion. The Ottomans had 20,000 troops in Libya. It wasn't enough to keep Libya in Ottoman hands. And so the Ottomans realised that they would have to give up Libya to the Italians. While this was happening, the Balkan provinces started the First Balkan War. In 1913, the Bulgarians went to war against the remaining members of the Balkan League because they were dissatisfied with their share of the spoils of the war. That gave Enver a chance to start regaining territory for the Ottoman Empire, and he led the regain of the city in Thrace, so that's northeastern Greece, called Edirne in Turkish or Adrianople in Greek. At the beginning of 1914, Enver was appointed Minister for War. That made him the deputy commander-in-chief of the military forces in Turkey. The Sultan was nominally commander-in-chief, but in operational terms, Enver served as that commander-in-chief for the duration of the war. Even married into the royal family, his fellow young Turk, Cemal, became governor of Syria. The other leading young Turk, Talat, had been minister for the interior. He was appointed Grand Vizier, aka Prime Minister. So the young Turks had established themselves as the triumvirate in power in the Ottoman Empire. These days, we know those three by the name Pasha. So he's known to history as Enver Pasha. Pasha is a title. It's the highest civil and military grade in the Ottoman Empire. You might have also heard of terms like Effendi and Bey, which in English we spell B-E-Y.
Not to be confused with Bey, B-A-E.
That's for your generation of listeners, I suspect. They are both ranks as well, and Pasha is the highest rank that could be achieved. So it can get a little bit confusing because suddenly the young Turks were known as Enver Pasha, Minister for War, Cemal Pasha, Governor of Syria, and Talat Pasha, the Prime Minister. In early August 1914, war broke out. In the Great War, the Ottomans were able to remain neutral until the end of October. They did realise, however, that war would give them opportunities to possibly regain some of that lost territory and re-establish the Ottoman Empire as a major power. It was no certainty as to which way the Ottoman Empire would go, as to which alliance they would join. In fact, early in 1914, they'd had excellent relations with both Britain and France. But slowly, the Ottoman Empire realised that they could use a German alliance in their long struggle against the Russians. Remember that Enver had been based in Berlin for a time, so his pro-German influence had dated for a while. The other clincher was that Germany had no competing interests, whereas Russia, France and Britain all did. During October of 1914, the Turkish Navy acquired two German warships. Those two warships then attacked Black Sea ports on the northern side of the Black Sea, so that was Russian territory near the Crimea. By the first week of November, both Russia and Britain had declared war on the Ottoman Empire.
The fantastic part of this story is that the government wasn't that keen on going to war. Enver Pasha decided he knows best as Minister for War, so he acquires these two German warships. They are still manned by the Germans. They are the soldiers on the ships. He orders them to sail through the straits into the Black Sea, and they start bombing the Russian coastline. Enver Pasha puts the German soldiers in Ottoman hats. so that the Russians know that the attack is coming from Ottomans, because they, once they see these Germans attacking them, they're just going to assume that they're Germans. I like that attention to detail Enver has by himself, without the authority of the government and the other two of the three pashas, declared war against Russia.
To the extent that the German admiral was actually commissioned as an admiral in the Ottoman Navy. So it was all completely legit. German military advisors arrived in Turkey to assist the Ottoman Empire, and German generals had leadership roles in the Ottoman army throughout the war. And one of the things that attracted Germany to an alliance with the Ottoman Empire was the fact that the Sultan, as Caliph, could appeal to Muslims worldwide, even those Muslims who weren't part of the Ottoman Empire. Germany was very conscious of the fact that there were Muslims in colonial French North Africa. There were Muslims in British India, and Germany liked the idea of the Caliph appealing to those Muslims to fight on the side of the Germans.
The British controlled India. The Ottomans wanted to begin an uprising in British India amongst the Muslim population in India. Enver Pasha realized that he didn't really want to start a jihad holy war against the British in India because he was worried about claims of independence. And so given that he controlled massive Muslim populations in his territory, he didn't want to start fomenting independence. So he pulled the pin on that plan. The Germans made an attempt, but they did so without the support of Enver Pasha, and that plan failed miserably.
In December 1914, Enver took his first opportunity to start regaining territory for the Ottoman Empire. He led a campaign in the Caucasus to regain those three provinces they'd lost to Russia in 1878. This campaign failed. It was winter time. The troops were poorly equipped.
They were very poorly supplied. As Uncle Ian mentioned, they did not have winter uniforms. They effectively froze to death. 25,000 soldiers in the Ottoman army died before even reaching the enemy, just marching through the mountains.
However, Enver was able to use it to his political advantage because he blamed the Armenians for siding with the Russians. So let's look a little bit about the history of the Armenians in Ottoman territory. They'd been seeking a homeland for many years, or at least, if not a homeland, then some sort of autonomy within the Ottoman Empire. The Armenians were Christian, but they were too thinly spread to have a homeland of their own. One of the things that caused much disruption was that as the Ottoman Empire shrank, that meant the Muslims in those countries suddenly became minorities. So a lot of the Muslims in those countries migrated to Ottoman territory because they would rather be under Muslim rule. The official death toll from the mid-1890s was that 37,000 Armenians were massacred and 300,000 were left homeless. We'll never know an exact number, but those numbers are a minimum. There were terrorist attacks right across the empire. That included in Istanbul itself, where there were some 8,000 killed in the reprisals. In April 1909, in Adana, which is in southern Turkey, there were 20,000 Armenians massacred. So the history of violence and repression against the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire had a long history. In 1914, that started to matter a lot more from an international perspective. The Armenians, being Christian, were seen by the Ottoman leaders as not fully loyal to the Ottoman Empire, given that the opponents of the Ottoman Empire, especially the Russians in that disputed territory in the Caucasus, were from a Christian background. So the Christian status of the Armenians meant that the Ottoman leaders realized that it was in their interest to solve the Armenian problem. And those words are rather chilling when we think about subsequent modern history, but using those quite deliberately because there's a lot of parallels with subsequent acts in Europe.
Uncle Ian is talking about Nazi Germany and the Holocaust and the final solution to the Jewish problem.
Under the cover of war, in April 1915, the repression of the Armenians commenced in earnest. They were forcibly deported to northern Syria through the desert, deliberately undersupplied and open to attack en route by Kurdish or Arab tribes. Now, the word genocide didn't exist yet. The word itself came into existence in 1943. At the time, that word was used not just about contemporary events in Europe, but it was used in the context of the suffering of the Armenians under the cover of the First World War. I'd like to quote a 2005 judgment by the International Association of Genocide Scholars, who said, quote, "The Young Turk government of the Ottoman Empire began a systematic genocide of its Armenian citizens, who were an unarmed Christian minority population. More than a million Armenians were exterminated through direct killing, starvation, torture, and forced death marches." End of quote. Subsequent documents show that Cemal Pasha and Talat Pasha had given their authority. Remember, during all of this, Enver Pasha was, in practical terms, commander-in-chief of the military, and therefore had direction of the forces that undertook this regime. Some of the documented methods that the Ottomans used as part of the repression and killing of the Armenians include, brace yourselves, deliberate morphine overdose, deliberate inoculation with typhoid, being put into boats in the Black Sea, which were then sunk so that people would drown. Men, women and children. Bodies were thrown into the Euphrates River. Toxic gas. Shut up in the churches and burned. Those were just some of the ways in which the Armenians suffered. There was also the destruction of cultural, religious and historical monuments. Churches and monasteries were destroyed or turned into mosques. Cemeteries were flattened. On the 13th of September 1915, the Ottoman Parliament passed a law whereby Armenian property, land, livestock, homes, became the property of the Ottoman government. Estimates vary as to the death toll, minimum 800,000, possibly as high as 1.5 million. Chillingly, remember that Germany was an ally of Turkey and had a strong military presence in Turkey throughout the war. A lot of statements from German officers sent back to Berlin attested to the murders and the mistreatment of the Armenians. Some German officers who served in the Ottoman Empire during the First World War subsequently took on roles in the Nazi regime. That included von Neurath, who later became a Nazi foreign minister. And interestingly, Hitler referenced the Armenian genocide when he was speaking to his generals in the lead up to the Second World War in terms of the amount of evidence that's available as to the genocide which occurred. It went as high as the leadership of Germany. The Chancellor, Bethmann Hollweg, wrote on the 31st of January 1917, remember he's writing about his ally in the middle of the First World War, quote, "The indications are that the Turks plan to eliminate the Greek element as enemies of the state, as they did earlier with the Armenians. The strategy implemented by the Turks is of displacing people to the interior without taking measures for their survival by exposing them to death, hunger, and illness. The abandoned homes are then looted and burnt or destroyed. Whatever was done to the Armenians is being repeated with the Greeks." So even the high level of German leadership was aware of the efforts of the Ottoman Empire to suppress the minorities in the empire. Along with the Armenians, the Greeks suffered losses numbered anywhere between 450,000 and 750,000. Similarly, the Assyrians, now they're based in southeast Anatolia or northern Persia, we'd now call that Iranian territory. They were a Christian minority and suffered losses which were possibly as high as 300,000. This is men, women and children. This isn't fighting men who were in uniform, who were armed. These are men, women and children. Those exact tolls we will never know, but even the minimum numbers that can be verified, a chilling reminder of what this particular regime, led by Enver Pasha as commander-in-chief, thought itself able to and justified in trying to achieve under the cover of war.
It's important to point out that while the reason provided for the genocide was that they were worried about the Christian minority joining forces with the Russians, that fear was just imagined. There was no planned resistance by the Armenians. No plan for them to join up with the Russians. The term genocide is very controversial in referring to the Armenian genocide. The Americans still haven't called it a genocide. Obama, in 2008, when campaigning for the presidency, promised the Armenian population of California that he would call it a genocide when he became president. He then refused to do so when he became president because he wanted access to Turkish military bases and didn't want to upset the Turks. The Turks are taught that, well, it was a tricky time. It was a lot of chaos going on. There was a war happening. Some people were hurt. It was a couple of bad soldiers did the wrong thing. That is the Turkish explanation for the Armenian genocide. We compare it to, say, for example, the mistreatment of the Japanese by the Americans during World War II, or the British and even Australian internment of the Italians during World War II. There was not widespread mass death in those examples.
As part of supporting their Russian allies, the British and the French in early 1915 were looking at how best to force a passage through the straits that link the Mediterranean Sea with the Black Sea. After numerous naval efforts, including some very brave Australian submariners in the AE2, it was decided that a land invasion on the western side of the Gallipoli Peninsula would enable the armies to then control the toings and froings through the straits. This was the genesis of the Gallipoli campaign. And so there were multiple landings on that fateful morning of the 25th of April 1915 with the French forces, the British forces, and the forces that we now know as the Anzacs, but under some surprising, to them, resistance. They didn't rate the Ottoman army. They thought they were under-equipped and ill-trained. What they subsequently realised was how brave they were, how well led they were. One of their leaders was that same Mustafa Kemal, who we subsequently got to know as Ataturk.
Ottoman soldiers were pretty unimpressive when invading other countries, but when defending their own country, they fought very well.
It took 8 months for the British leaders to realise they weren't going to be able to force their way through the straits from the Gallipoli Peninsula, and hence the evacuation at the end of 1915, which was gold for Enver because that meant he had more troops at his disposal and he could move them back to the Caucasus or back to the Arab regions in order to try and stem the flow of war in those territories. Let's look at what happened to Enver Pasha. The Sultan was still in nominal power, and on the 4th of October 1918, Enver was dismissed from his role as Minister for War by the Sultan. On the 30th of October, the Turks signed the armistice of Mudros, so they were out of the war. 2 days later, the three pashas fled. Enver fled to Berlin and then to Moscow. He started to work for a German-Soviet alliance. When reading about his subsequent work, the term that kept going through my head was mercenary. During the time he was working in Moscow, the Turkish people were still struggling with the terms of the armistice. And a number of countries, in fact, invaded Turkey in order to make sure that the Turks did not resist the terms of the armistice. This led to the Turkish War of Independence versus the occupying powers. And in July 1921, Enver wanted to be part of the Turkish War of Independence. He was still a very strong nationalist. However, he'd fallen out badly with the senior Turkish leader, Mustafa Kemal, the same Mustafa Kemal who led Turkish forces at Gallipoli. Enver and Mustafa Kemal did not have a good working relationship. Kemal had become more realistic and realised that the Ottoman Empire was not going to have a future, whereas Enver still saw it as very pro-expansionist. So Enver wasn't able to get a place in the Turkish War of Independence. Enver returned to Moscow, earned the trust of Lenin. Lenin then sent him to Turkestan in Central Asia to fight against the anti-Bolshevik forces, the Basmichi, who were of a Muslim background. Enver then changed sides, started working with the Basmichi, and he wanted to help form a Muslim Central Asian confederation, which would stretch all the way from Anatolia, Asian Turkey, all the way through to Western China. I also like this quote from a 1989 book about the peace after the First World War, written by Fromkin, talking about Enver in his time working in Central Asia, so towards the end of his life, well after the end of the First World War. Quote, "He was a vain, strutting man who loved uniforms, medals and titles. For use in stamping official documents, he ordered a golden seal that described him as Commander-in-Chief of all of the armies of Islam, son-in-law of the Caliph, and representative of the Prophet." End of quote. Those words were hardly going to endear him to other rulers of or Muslim territories that had national ambitions.
I love his seal. How good's that seal?
Gold. That's dictator tick.
His love of medals?
Yeah, I knew you'd like that. He was leading a force in 1922 near Dushanbe when he was killed in a cavalry charge. So he died at the age of 40 with his Central Asian Confederation dream unfulfilled. Those mainly Muslim Central Asian republics became incorporated into the Soviet Union and only obtained independence in the 1990s. As far as the Ottomans go, in July 1923, the Treaty of Lausanne was signed. The Turkish parliament had abolished the role of sultan, and the final sultan went into exile. On the 29th of October 1923 was the proclamation of the Republic of Turkey, and the first president was that same Mustafa Kemal, subsequently named, given the honorific of Atatürk.
Mustafa Atatürk? Atatürk means father of the Turks.
So after the war, the Ottoman regime that accepted the responsibility of the armistice was understandably keen to distance itself from the fate of the Armenians. They convened courts-martial in absentia and passed 18 death sentences. Now by this time, Cemal, Talat and Enver had all fled. Cemal and Talat were subsequently tracked down and killed, vigilante style, and as we've heard, Enver was killed in military action. After the proclamation of Turkey, Atatürk was, again understandably, keen to put the blame onto the Young Turk Party, and he is quoted in the Los Angeles Examiner of the 1st of August 1926 as saying that the Young Turk Party was responsible for millions of our Christian subjects who were ruthlessly driven en masse from their homes and massacred. That was a pretty strong admission for Atatürk to make in the early days of the Republic of Turkey. In Turkey today, Enver is seen as primarily responsible for the Ottoman entrance into World War I, and a lot of that was because of his German sympathies. As a direct result of the Ottoman entrance into World War I, the loss of the war and the subsequent collapse of the empire.
It's time to introduce our next dictator. Up against Enver Pasha, we have the Turkish president, Recep Erdogan, who has been the leader of Turkey from 2003 to present, which makes him our first dictator who's currently in power, still making headlines. After the Ottoman Empire lost World War I, the empire was dissolved and split up, and the Republic of Turkey was formed by Mustafa Atatürk, who is a revered figure in Turkey. The modern Turkish state spans across Europe and Asia. It sits between Greece and the Mediterranean Sea to its west, Iraq, Syria, and Iran to its southeast, and Georgia to its northwest in the Caucasus. Istanbul, which literally straddles the divide between Europe and Asia, is Turkey's biggest city, but the capital is Ankara. Important to mention, Mustafa Atatürk turned Turkey into a constitutional democracy with an elected parliament and prime minister and independent court, so it's a modern Western state. A president would also be elected, but he's just a figurehead without much power. And Atatürk turned Turkey into a secular state, despite being a majority Muslim nation. This means there's no state religion in Turkey. Religion and politics are kept completely separate, and Atatürk even implemented a headscarf ban for women working in the public sector. He didn't want there to be any sign of Islam within the government. This will become very important as we get to know Erdogan. So, Recep Erdogan was born in Kasımpaşa, a poor neighborhood of Istanbul, on the 26th of February 1954. There's a good chance I'm mispronouncing that. Erdogan spent most of his childhood in Rize, in eastern Turkey, on the Black Sea. As a teen, he worked on the street selling water bottles to truck drivers and other similar hustles to make a little bit of money. He played semi-professional soccer in Istanbul and was offered a deal by a prominent Turkish club, but his dad wouldn't let him go and play. And that stadium where they play is now called the Recep Erdogan Stadium. At school, he became very interested in Islam and nationalist politics. And his bio states that he earned a degree in business administration at Marmara University in Istanbul under the Faculty of Economic and Administrative Sciences. However, there's a good chance he didn't attend university at all. In 2016, there was a Turkish hashtag campaign to force Erdogan to prove his credentials. The hashtag was, hashtag either your diploma or you resign, which I assume is more catchy in Turkish. The official website of Marmara University states that the aforementioned faculty never existed, but that the Faculty of Economic and Administrative Sciences was formed in 1982, after he supposedly attended the university. It is a prerequisite for being president that you have a university degree, so Erdogan has never responded to these claims. He began his political career by joining the National Salvation Party in 1976, which is an Islamist political party. Quick description of Islamism. Islamism is the desire to impose Islam over society. So, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran is an Islamist country. Its laws are based on religion, so in contrast to Turkey, women are imprisoned if they don't wear a headscarf in Iran. ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Islamist terrorist groups that want to set up an Islamist country, but some Islamists, like the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and the aforementioned National Salvation Party in Turkey, use democracy rather than terrorists to achieve their Islamist ambitions. Erdogan joined the Islamist Welfare Party in 1983 and was elected to parliament in 1991, but was barred from his seat due to some technicality. The party was later banned for being unconstitutional, for breaking the Turkey's secularist constitution. In Turkey, you cannot have an openly Islamist party. So he decided to run for mayor of Istanbul instead, and he won. And as mayor, he had a lot of achievements. He even received an award from the UN, who have an excellent record on such matters. He received the award. He started to show his Islamist tendencies when he banned the sale of alcohol in cafes. And he eventually, his mayoralty would end when he was arrested and imprisoned for reciting an Islamic poem, which is deemed to be illegal for incitement to violence and religious hatred. The poem included the lines, "The mosques are our barracks, the domes our helmets, the minarets our bayonets, and the faithful our soldiers." He served 3 months in prison and was banned from ever holding political office. But that wouldn't stop him. After his release, he formed the Justice and Development Party, the AK Party. In 2002, the party won the election and his mate Abdullah Gül became prime minister, who overturned the ban on Erdogan holding office. And then another election was held 3 months later and Erdogan became prime minister. He had some early achievements. In his rule, he delivered human rights reform for ethnic and religious minorities. And this was done primarily so that Turkey could fulfill its aim of joining the European Union, which requires a level of decency amongst its members. He ended the death penalty and allowed ethnic Kurds to speak Kurdish language on television. He invested in infrastructure and he doubled the number of airports and built roads and high-speed rail. He increased private hospitals and that competition forced the Turkish public hospitals to improve their standards. So that improved the standards of healthcare in Turkey. Also passed a law providing free healthcare to children. So some good stuff there from Erdogan. Unfortunately, it's all downhill. In 2007, Erdogan arrested 300 military officers involved in the 2003 sledgehammer coup conspiracy to overthrow the government. However, it appears to be an attempt by Erdogan to limit opposition within the military. The military has removed 4 elected governments, and the military sees it themselves as the guardians of Turkish secularism. The 2007 sledgehammer trials were seen as phony. the trial of the 300 military officers involved in the plans to stage a coup against Erdogan. The reason the trials were seen as phony was that the plans of the coup were supposedly written in 2003, and yet the documents were written on Microsoft Word 2007. Maybe these guys are just ahead of their time. So a little bit dodgy there from Erdogan. But Turkey's institutions are very strong. The constitution carries a lot of weight, so it's been difficult for Erdogan to seize control, but Erdogan knows all the tricks. His opposition party candidate's sex tapes conveniently leaked just before the election. So his mate, I mentioned earlier, Abdullah Gulen, ended support in 2003 and fled to the US, where he's a strong critic of Erdogan. And so Erdogan eliminated all the judges he believed are supporters of Gulen and passed a law in 2014, giving him more control of the previously independent judiciary. So he's slowly salami slicing away the checks and balances on his power. And Erdogan exercises incredible control over the media. He restructured private media companies and arrests journalists and bans certain outlets from his press conferences. The massive 2013 protests against Erdogan's growing authoritarianism and that harsh crackdown were not covered by the Turkish media for 3 days. For example, CNN International covered the protests, while at the same time, CNN Turkey broadcast a documentary about penguins. Media outlets that did cover the protests were fined for showing content that might be distressing to kids. Nice little excuse there. And in the 2014 election that followed those protests in 2013, the state-run media gave Erdogan 204 minutes of airtime and less than 3 minutes to his opponents. In that two-year period, 2,000 journalists were charged with offences, and even Miss Universe was arrested for criticising Erdogan. He followed that by banning Twitter and YouTube. A conversation was leaked to YouTube of a recording where Erdogan is telling his son to empty his home of all the embezzled money that they had stolen from Turkey. Not a good look. He's even blocked the entire internet for the southeast of the country. And silencing opposition doesn't stop at the borders of his country. In 2016, Erdogan demanded that the Germans arrest and charge German satirist Jan Böhmermann after he read a poem on German TV that insulted the Turkish president using profane language. In Germany, abusive criticism of a foreign state leader was a punishable offence in 2016, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel apologised to Erdogan for the poem. She later called this apology a mistake. But Merkel approved the satirist's criminal prosecution and he was charged. Journalist Douglas Murray of the British political magazine The Spectator ran a competition with $1,000 prize money for the best offensive poem about Erdogan. And I have the winning poem here if you'd like to hear it. There was a young fellow from Ankara who was a terrific wankara till he sowed his wild oats with the help of a goat, but he didn't even stop to thank her. That winning entry was by Boris Johnson, the current British Prime Minister. Thankfully, the case against the German satirist was dropped in 2018. But you can see the thin skin that Erdogan has. He doesn't like being criticised. The big event in Erdogan's time as dictator was the attempted coup that took place on the 15th of July 2016. A faction within the army attempted to overthrow the government. The faction states the reason for the coup was Erdogan's erosion of secularism, the elimination of democratic rule, the disregard for human rights, and Turkey's loss of credibility in the international arena. They attempted to seize control of several key places in Ankara and Istanbul. They took control of all broadcast media. But ironically, Erdogan was saved by social media. The coup was defeated by forces loyal to Erdogan and citizens he drove into the streets with pleas on social media. And there's footage of him desperately asking citizens to jump in front of tanks and stop the coup. It has been claimed that the coup was actually a self-coup organized by Erdogan himself to consolidate his power. One piece of evidence for this is that when Erdogan flew from his holiday house in the countryside to Istanbul, rebel soldiers attempting the coup flying F-16 jets had Erdogan's private plane in their sights, but didn't shoot it down. They allowed him to land in Istanbul and Erdogan held on to power. They had their chance to stop him and they didn't. This idea of the self-coup is probably better backed up by what happens next. After the coup, 120 media outlets were closed. Thousands of journalists and academics were arrested. Reporters Without Borders said, Erdogan hides his aggressive dictatorship under a veneer of democracy. The arrest of 40,000 political opponents, including judges and soldiers, followed. 21,000 teachers had their licenses revoked. Not sure how that's necessary. And 160,000 Turkish people were fired for their jobs for not supporting Erdogan. So it's not just killings and arrests. You get people fired if they don't hold the right opinions. He's outlawed all peaceful opposition by sentencing people to fake terrorism charges. Professor Sedat Lasana has said, quote, guns and violence will become the sole alternative for legally expressing free thought. Erdogan has since called the coup a gift from God. In 2017, he had a referendum changing the constitution to give himself more executive control. He won that referendum, and the historically ceremonial presidency is given substantial executive powers, while the role of prime minister was abolished. The referendum victory gave Erdogan also control over which judges get appointed to court. The president previously appointed 4 of 22 judges. Now the president and the parliament appoint 13 of 13 judges. The Turkish tradition of a secular independent judiciary appears to be dead. Let's get into a few fun policies. Domestically, he's called for amnesty for rapists who marry their victims. So the crime is not committing the act of rape. It is not having the decency to marry the woman that you've raped. In terms of Islamism, the controversial Islamist policies, he's revoked the famous headscarf ban, allowing women to wear headscarves working in the public sector. He doesn't really accept the notion of Islamist terrorism. He famously stated, there is no Islamic terror. There's a Turkish satire website called Zeytun, which is like the Turkish version of Batuta Advocate or The Onion. They created a joke story containing the lines, Erdogan's claims that there is no Islamic terror have left several Islamic terror organizations heartbroken. A press release from Al-Qaeda's officers said, the Prime Minister's remarks are very discouraging. We are doing our best. In 2007, he stated that moderate Islam is a Western fantasy. These descriptions are very ugly. It is offensive and an insult to our religion. There is no moderate or immoderate Islam. Islam is Islam, and that's it. He's also looking to make adultery a criminal offense. He first attempted this in 2004, but held back when the European Union wouldn't let Turkey join if he did pass those laws. Now that the EU membership is looking less likely, he's looking to reintroduce that. Just want to mention a little bit about his corruption. We touched on the embezzlement of funds. He's also constructed a pure white presidential palace by bulldozing part of the Ataturk National Park. It's over 1,000 rooms and costs $600 million, much of which was spent on the extended use of imported marble. Initially, Erdogan had it built as the Prime Minister's Palace, but when Erdogan became president, it was decided that their palace should house the president. Oh, God. It was initially declared illegal, but it was overturned by Erdogan's growing executive powers. It's called Aksaray, which means white palace in Turkish, but the people of Turkey call it the Kasak Saray, which means illegal palace. He does all this while attempting to portray his family as living frugally. This is despite the fact that his electricity bill is $300,000 per month. He's got the aircon on and lost the remote. I don't know. Let's talk about his foreign policies because they're pretty interesting. We've spoken a lot about the Armenian genocide. Erdogan does not accept the Armenian genocide. He even said of Omar al-Bashir's government in Sudan, who carried out the ethnic cleansing of up to 400,000 people in the Darfur region of Sudan, Erdogan said, it is not possible for those who belong to the Muslim faith to carry out genocide. All right. In terms of Syria, Erdogan has funded anti-Assad fighters. So Assad is the president of Syria, although American vice president at the time, Joe Biden, said that Erdogan was funding ISIS. Erdogan said that Biden must apologize or his history to me. Biden did apologize. Biden's claim is not without merit. In 2014, there was a lorry scandal in which 100 mortar shells and 30,000 bullets were intercepted en route to Syrian rebel groups, most likely to have been Al-Qaeda and ISIS. He invaded Syria in 2019 after the US withdrawal to attack Kurdish-controlled areas. It's worth mentioning Cyprus because Turkey invaded the independent Mediterranean nation of Cyprus in 1974 and took over the eastern half of Cyprus. Erdogan initially supported a referendum on unification. He now says that Turkey will be in Cyprus forever. And this has caused him some problems because Turkey's trying to join the European Union, but negotiations stalled because Turkey doesn't recognize Cyprus. The Europeans probably don't want Turkey in the European Union, particularly now that he's become more authoritarian and more Islamist. It's hard to see that Turkey could join the EU. Also, with refugees coming through Turkey from Syria to get to Europe, Erdogan has used this as leverage to get what he wants from Europe. In October 2015, he threatened to send over 1 million refugees into Europe, saying, quote, "We can open the doors to Greece and Bulgaria. We can put the refugees on buses," end quote. The tactic seemed to work. The EU promised Turkey $6 billion a year, and it delayed its report on Turkey's human rights until after the Turkish elections. And they also agreed to reconsider Turkey's application to join the European Union. Erdogan has also said he wants to increase the Turkish population in Europe to increase Turkish power there. Addressing the Turkish people living in Europe, Erdogan said, "Make not 3, but 5 children, because you are the future of Europe." That sounds like something you'd hear in a right-wing conspiracy theory, but he did say it. In terms of his opinions on Israel, he was initially friendly towards Israel, but has recently accused Israel of a genocide against the Palestinians. He's also called them more barbaric than Hitler. Always helpful bringing up the Holocaust with the Israelis.
Over time, he's been backwards and forwards with his foreign policy. Sometimes he gets on with the Greeks, sometimes he doesn't, depending on the European question. He has had various rapprochements with Russia, with the UK and with China, as well as being very outspoken about the Syrian regime. He's also been outspoken about the regime in Myanmar, which is anti-Muslim regime.
And we have to touch on Australia, of course. His relationship with Australia and New Zealand soured after the Christchurch mosque shooting. He shows the footage at many campaign rallies, and he was referencing World War One and Gallipoli when he said, "Any Australians and Kiwis that come here would be sent back in coffins like their grandfathers." I really dislike this man.
He's certainly given you a lot of reasons to dislike him, Scott, and some of those quotes, the type of character that he is, the efforts that he made after the alleged coup in mid-2016, that it then gave him an excuse to attack his enemies in the media and the judiciary and also in the Kurdish minority, really speak to the type of character that he is. Yeah, he's given us a lot of reasons to dislike him in this age to be suppressing the media to the extent that he is, and the hypocrisy of banning social media except when it suits him in the 21st century is a disgrace.
I like how he started his career being imprisoned for a poem that he wrote, that he read out, and then now he tries to get a German imprisoned for reciting a dodgy poem about him. It's time to choose a winner. This is going to be a tough one. Look, in terms of biggest, baddest, meanest, you've got to put Enver Pasha at number one. In terms of dictator bingo, repression, particularly his ability to turn a modern Western-style democracy into another Middle Eastern basket case run by a strongman, it's quite impressive in the worst way possible. Uncle Em, where are you sitting on this one?
It's really tight. It's hard not to look at what happened to the Armenians without loathing the Young Turks and what Enver Pasha stood for. But when you look at everything Erdogan's done over time to reverse the Turkish positions on things like the headscarves, on things like the Turkish attitude to Europe, depending on his moods. It must be difficult living in Turkey, and they must feel like they're walking on eggshells as to what they're allowed to do and what they see the future of their country. Is it part of Europe? Does Erdogan have ambitions to bring back the Ottoman Empire through encouraging Turks to populate different countries? And of course, as you mentioned, Scott, we're recording this while Erdogan is still in power. So we really don't know how this is going to end. In terms of significance, Enver Pasha is accused of dragging the Ottoman Empire into the First World War on the German side, then not only gave them the opportunity to commit the atrocities, but also led to the fall of the Ottoman Empire. Taking a long view of history, that's pretty significant.
What's interesting, the Pashas brought about the end of the Ottoman Empire, and Erdogan has brought about the end of a near 100-year democracy.
I can't overlook the atrocities that happened during the First World War. However, we have to acknowledge that Erdogan's form to date, especially in the repression of the Kurdish minority, it's not out of the question he could make liars of us down the track, but my vote is for Pasha.
I'm going to agree. The death toll amongst the Christians in the Ottoman Empire is too high for us to go any other way. Congratulations to Enver Pasha. Enver remains in the tournament to be crowned history's biggest dictator, narrowly defeating Recep Erdogan, who is my least favourite person alive at the moment. Next episode, we are going to Africa. I've been looking forward to this episode for the past year when this idea came into my head. Robert Mugabe versus Idi Amin. That's the next episode.
We should give another plug to our email address and to our Twitter feed.
That is libertydiespodcast@gmail.com, at libertydiespod on Twitter. Quick note, people have suggested we cover Trump, so we stop receiving messages about that. I'll just say, if he cancels the election in November, we'll do a Trump episode. Until then, we can't do it.
As we speak, the next election is 4 months away. Anything could happen between now and then, including a cure for the virus.
And President Kanye.
Which party does he represent?
I think he represents the Kanye party, if I had to guess. Thank you for listening. See you next time.